and gentlemen, I'm Alfred Adisk, and this is Financial Survival, our Wednesday night program for the ninth day of November, year of our Lord, 2016. Our James Corbett will be our guest after the first break, calling in from Japan. In the meantime, we'll talk about the markets and a few other odds and ends. And let's start with markets after the Trump victory. Just went wild. The overseas market for gold actually jumped by $50 an ounce. And then, by the time we got back and the markets opened in the United States, it fell back down to where it was a little below. There was actually a loss. And then, by the time the day closed, the U.S. markets closed today, it was up $3.10 an ounce to $1,279.20. Silver was up 11 cents today to $18.56 an ounce. Platinum was down $3 to $1,004. Palladium was up 14 to $681 per ounce. And when we go down, crude oil is 23 cents down in the aftermarket, the overseas market right now, to $45.04 per barrel. U.S. dollar index is down 0.21 in the aftermarket, but it was up during the day. It's currently at 98.38 on the U.S. dollar index. Dow Jones it finished 256 points up, actually almost 257 points up at 18,589, but it dropped hundreds of points earlier in the day. NASDAQ is up 58 points to 5,251. New York Stock Exchange is up 112 points, 113 to 10,643. Standard & Poor's is up 24 to 2,163. Interesting, big reactions, fairly rapid corrections in the overnight market. As I say, gold wound up $3.10. In the U.S. market, up $3.10 in the U.S. market. But in the overnight market, world spot price is up another $8.70 right now, and gold is currently global price $1,286.90 per ounce. That's a bid price. So a lot of volatility, but not an enormous amount of change. I think the biggest surprise to me is the huge jump that took place yesterday, 22 hours ago, 24 hours ago, whatever, a little less than that, 20 hours ago there was, that took place on the foreign markets. It was interesting to me and something that I don't understand. Why did the foreign markets react so strongly to Trump being elected? I would have thought that they would pay a little less attention to the U.S. election. I would have thought it would be less cause for fear, panic, whatever, greed, whatever it was that moved them. They moved big time, at least for a little while. And I'm not sure if that was caused by one or two big market manipulators or public in general was moving dramatically. They panicked or something happened to stampede them in there for raise the price of gold by $50 in just a matter of hours. Interesting stuff, and I'm not sure what it all means right now, but if they can do it yesterday, they can do it again. If we can see $50 changes in the price of gold on one day in the foreign markets last night, we can see it tomorrow night. Might even see it tonight. Hard to say what's going to happen. What else we've got? Here's an article from the New York Post entitled, "Life Got Worse in the United States Since the 2008 Financial Crisis, and Here's Why." Last January, the Gallup organization randomly polled 1,022 adults in all 50 states and the District of Columbia about whether they were better off than they were 8 years ago. Gallup found that only 50% of those surveyed said they were better off now compared with 8 years ago. 42% said they weren't, and 6% volunteered that they were just as well off, and the remaining people had no opinion, which means they probably lived in one of the states where pot is legal. It's just, maybe not. Maybe that's not the reason. They had no opinion, but they didn't. In 2000, 73% said they were better off than in 1992. This most recent study, again, only 50% said they were better off. 42% said they weren't. So what gives? According to the economic statistics being put out by Washington, a lot more people should be happier with their financial situation right now. The unemployment rate is reportedly down sharply since the Great Recession. There have been 18 million jobs created since 2008. The U.S. economy, as measured by the gross domestic product, has been rising almost without interruption. But have they really? You know, we get so many phony reports out of government that it's hard to know if we get anything true or at all, but you have to be skeptical of any numbers the government provides. And so I'm led to wonder, are these rises in income or job numbers, are they reported rather than real? For example, are all those reported jobs created, were they created as full-time jobs or part-time jobs? This article continues. It says, first, let's take a look at those 18 million new jobs. Right now, the United States has 145.9 million jobs. And annual growth in employment has been unspectacular but steady. Those 145.9 million jobs are only 6 million more than the country had back in late 2007, which is when the hard times began. 6 million new jobs from the 2000 peak. That's just not enough when you need to put people back to work, plus absorb all the folks who are trying to enter the workplace for the first time. In fact, the experts generally thought that 150,000 jobs a month were needed just to put the newcomers to work. 150,000 new jobs a month formula, more than 16 million jobs would have been needed in the last 9 years just for new workers, and they claim to have created 6 million. About 10 million short. And they point out, and they say, maybe that's why people aren't particularly happy right now. The reportedly low unemployment rate of 4.9% is a joke because it doesn't count people who have given up looking for work. Even by the Labor Department's optimistic standards, the real rate is closer to 10% when you include people who have become mildly discouraged or want a full-time job but can only find part-time work. Add to that figure all the Americans who've completely disappeared from the workforce because they've given up, and the jobless rate is probably closer to 20%. Now, that's interesting to me because I agree with the numbers, and this is coming from the New York Post. Right? They're admitting numbers that we've talked about on the program for a couple of years now. Government says the unemployment rate is only 4.9%. Other figures indicate 10%, and people like John Williams, ShadowStats.com, has calculated up to 23%. Here's the New York Post is in the same ballpark. And they're saying maybe that's why people aren't happy. Or is it because a large percentage of new jobs created aren't good ones? Quality of a job is hard to gauge, except that everyone would seem to agree that if it doesn't have benefits, it's not good. And if someone has to have two poor-paying jobs to make ends meet instead of one good-paying job, the need is greater for even more new jobs. One of the things that's happened, Obamacare. Obamacare has created millions of part-time jobs, not because we need part-time jobs, but because people have got employers wanting to get away from the burdens imposed by Obamacare have cut people from full-time workers that would be eligible for Obamacare and cause the employer to pay into Obamacare to part-time workers who have to worry about getting Obamacare on their own, and the employer is absolved from his obligation to help provide Obamacare for all of his employees. So Obamacare is part of the reason we've had part-time jobs in this country rather than full-time. The shift to poor-paying jobs has caused the median household income in the United States, after adjusting for inflation, to be 4.6% lower in 2015 compared with 2007. It means, in broad strokes, that your income, folks, is of almost 5% lower today than it was in 2007. You haven't improved. You've actually fallen back a little bit. Now, it's not true for everybody. Some people are undoubtedly doing well, but on average, we're down almost 5% compared to 2007. Well, that's another cause for being upset and unhappy with the economy. Real construction spending is still down near 25% from its pre-recession peak. Meanwhile, the gross domestic product is setting records for the slowest recovery from a recession in history. Both political parties can take the blame for it, but it's usually for this problem. But it's usually the one that occupies the White House that gets punished, and that may explain Hillary's defeat. It offers some explanation for Hillary's defeat. This election has gone far beyond money issues, but even some of the distractions are about money, like Donald Trump's taxes and Hillary Clinton's charitable foundation. And again, this is the New York Post speaking here, and it says, Trump is a wise ass who seems unable to control what he says and is thinking. Hillary is a liar and a thief. Neither should be president. That's according to the New York Post. This article was written yesterday. We're reading it now. But it's still interesting. Hillary was once a senator from New York. Trump is a New York native. And the newspaper that printed this article is the New York Post. It seems that the New York Post, neither Hillary nor Trump are favorite sons or daughters of the people of New York. If it's true that neither Hillary or Trump deserve to be president, who should be blamed? We should blame the two major political parties, and perhaps even the current election laws that make money so critical to winning the White House. If the politicians didn't need and were not allowed to acquire so much money to run for the presidency, they might not have to be such a pack of crooks or oligarchs. But if you could get elected to president, I mean, I have no idea how much was spent in this last election. Tens of millions, might be a couple hundred million, maybe. If you could be elected president less expensively, then it would be possible for people to run with for the presidency without having to cater to the super rich in this country. You can get by with contributions that you could acquire from ordinary rank and file American people. When we make the election so extraordinarily expensive, we also make the contending politicians increasingly vulnerable to the super rich. They're the only ones who can put up. They're not the only ones, but generally speaking, they're the ones that can make the big contributions that can help politicians to perhaps win the White House or the Senate or the Congress. And as a result, we have politicians that are increasingly grateful to the wealthy rather than responsible to the ordinary Americans. And I think that creates a problem that needs to be resolved somewhere along the line. I don't know how to do this exactly. I don't have a suggestion of how this is going to be done. But we need to somehow wean the politicians from money given by the super rich. It gives them a disproportionate voice in politics. What this country doesn't need is a new president, as much as it needs a restructured system for electing politicians that doesn't presume political campaign contributions, that is to say, money, to be expressions of political free speech. A few years ago, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that money, political campaign contributions given to politicians, was a form of free speech. Well, that's interesting. And I think it's irrational, and I think it's dangerous to sit back and consider that. Suppose if I give a politician a couple $1,000, $10,000, $100,000 under the table, can that be excused as an expression of free speech? Because if it can, what am I paying income tax on? What are you paying income tax on? How is it that the money I receive is not an expression of political free speech from my employer? I mean, the argument can be made either way, but if we're going to consider money given to politicians as an expression of free speech, then why can't I consider money given to me an expression of free speech? And what is the tax on free speech? What tax should be implied on speech that's protected by the First Amendment to the Constitution? And nobody has an answer for that. No one should even consider answering that question, probably. But we're compelled to consider that question, as strange as it sounds, because the Supreme Court said if you give money to a politician, that's just like sitting down and talking to him. That's political free speech. It was an unwise decision, and that's contrary to the best interest, near as I can see, contrary to the best interest of the American people. What else have we got? Here's an article from Yahoo News. It's from Deutsche Bank. They responded to Trump's election saying, bye-bye globalization. According to Deutsche Bank, which is on the ropes and probably technically bankrupt, biggest bank in Germany and probably bankrupt, I say globalization has reached its peak. We're about to witness an unwinding of the trend that's dominated economics and trade for decades. This is according to one of Deutsche Bank's best known strategists. Writing for the bank's FX blog, chief Forex strategist George Saravelos argued that eight years on from the collapse of Lehman Brothers, numerous signs point to the slow death of globalization. But New World Order is having a hard time. One world government is suffering setbacks. We see it in Brexit, we see it in the Trump election, and so on. The article goes on, if 2008 marked the trigger this year, it's likely to be remembered for signaling the persistence of a new mega trend, the peak and likely unwind of globalization. The world has been globalized, has been on a globalizing trend since the end of World War II. Looking at the evidence this year, there is compelling reason to believe that globalism is dying. Again, what evidence? Brexit. Britain's breaking loose from the European Union. Trump is being elected as a populist here in the United States. Other nations in Europe are considering rejecting the European Union and going their own way. We are headed back into nationalization, and we're going to talk about this concept, the difference between globalization and nationalization, when James Corbett arrives. Should be here after this next bunch of commercials, and we'll talk about globalization, nationalization. What are the reasons? What are the consequences? What are the dangers? Are we in more trouble if we get closer to nationalization? I'm Alfred Adisk. This is Financial Survival. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. And our guest is James Corbett, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, from thecorbettreport.com, talking about all things economic and geopolitical and sometimes even humane. I saw that you had an article that you had that you just published. I have the wrong script here in front of me. Hang on just a second. There we go. You printed an article just lately that only love can defeat the New World Order. Now that's kind of strange. The title, are you wearing flowers in your hair or anything like that?
Not too well. If I had hair, maybe I would. Right. No, certainly not. I hope it does strike people as a strange sentiment, because I hope it is in 180 degree complete sharp contrast to everything that people are hearing and experiencing from all of the media, mainstream, alternative, and otherwise, which I have noted, and I talked about just last week on the Corbett Report. I did a episode on You Are Being Programmed to Hate, where I've talked about the hatred and the vitriol and the division and the scorn and the rancor that is being increased and ratcheted up, that I think we all feel. I think we've all seen come bubbling up to the surface, especially during this 2016 selection cycle. And I want to stand in 180 degree complete contrast to that. I want to be on the other side of that fence, not talking about hatred and division and scorn and how you can be at war with your neighbor, but how people can overcome that tendency. And I hope it's not pie in the sky, flowery rhetoric that means nothing. I hope there's something to it, because otherwise we will be divided and ruled.
You know, I watched the election yesterday from 8 o'clock at night until 3 o'clock in the morning, or whenever Trump finally accepted and stopped speaking and whatever. One of the things that impressed me about it, I happen to be a Trump supporter, or at least a Hillary, you know, antagonist. I watched people in the Trump audience who were deeply wounded, in the Hillary audience that were deeply wounded when she lost. They were crying. They looked to me just like Trump supporters. And it kind of surprised me, because the only thing I've been hearing is how vicious and violent and criminal the people that are involved in the Trump or in the Hillary campaign were. And it turns out that the supporters, I was surprised to see, they look just like me. Right? I didn't see that to be true. I didn't see viciousness, violence, and the rest of that. I was kind of surprised. But I was also surprised to hear them complaining about Trump supporters as being vicious and violent. Right? And I thought, wait a second, you don't get it. And it is amazing to me how little the Hillary supporters understand about the Trump supporters, and apparently how little the Trump supporters understand about the Hillary supporters. It has been a real polarizing election. There has been great division, just as you pointed out in your article about there will be a divided U.S. public that hates the other half as a consequence of the Trump election. or I think you meant as a consequence of the Trump election. And you don't think we're going to heal that anytime soon?
Well, I mean, that's up to us, ultimately. And it's up to people having insights and epiphanies like you just had, because it is a surprising phenomenon to see people on the other side of that fence being similar to yourself. How could that possibly be? We are almost being taught that it's almost like a different species. This is a different class of human being. This isn't like you or me. And I mean, there's so much irony here, and I have to admit, there's Schadenfreude that comes along with this to see the hypocrisy. But this is the way that I contextualize this, because I've been doing the Corbett Report now since 2007. So I started in the Bush era, strongly against Bush and everything he was doing. So I was used to being called a left-wing pinko commie by the right-wingers and being loved and embraced by people on the left side of the equation. And then on January 20th, 2009, I suddenly became this right-wing fascist, literally Hitler, and people on the left couldn't understand why I wasn't enthused about hope and change Obama style. And suddenly people on the right thought that I was a sane and reasonable person. And hey, it looks like that pendulum is going to swing again. So what does this mean politically? I mean, just look at one example of this that I thought was particularly striking, and I think it encapsulates so much of what we're seeing right now. It's an article up on Slate.com, obviously a heavily left-leaning outlet, I believe part of the Washington Post group, and they wrote this article just a few hours after the election at 2:38 a.m. on November 9th. It's worse than you think. Donald Trump assumes the office of the presidency at the peak of its imperial powers and unhindered by the drag of divided government, where they say, so now we have a president-elect with authoritarian tendencies assuming a presidency that has never been more powerful. Over the course of the past 20 years, we have invested ever more authority in the executive branch of government. We have given presidents the power to launch war without congressional consent, and we have given them the power to rewrite the crucial details of domestic policy without any legislative stamp of approval. We rarely worried about investing the presidency with such latitude. It seemed a rational response to legislative gridlock, the only way to keep the country moving, and it seemed reasonable to believe that the considerable power of the presidency would be wielded by a person who respected the Constitution and the norms of American government. Translation: all of those powers that we loved under Obama, we will now hate under Trump, and we will love once again, once it is a Democrat, once again in office in 4 to 8 to 12, whatever, however many years. How ridiculous, how saddening, what an indictment of the entire system that it works time and time and time again, that you get half of the public seeing through, seeing the real problem, seeing what's really going on, seeing that what they have been doing was a mistake, and it will just swing back and forth. The pendulum will continue to swing left to right. The left will be awake, the right will be asleep, the right will be awake, the left will be asleep, and all the time government powers continue to expand. So every time that happens, every time there is a pendulum swing, I think a few more people fall through those cracks. A few more people see the system for what it is. And this is the moment. This is the moment where we might have a chance at reaching out to some of those leftists who supported everything under Obama to maybe see why that isn't a good idea and why we shouldn't do that. But it's a small window of opportunity for before people launch into the hatred. Just hate anything Trump and then love anything your team does. Uh-huh. So we have to break through this conditioning. And this is the kind of moment of opportunity to seize that.
Does the problem you're describing have anything to do with the statement that those don't learn from history or are destined to repeat it? I mean,
it's even more fundamental than that, though, isn't it? Because it's not, yes, it is that, but it's not just that people aren't learning from it. It's that there is that mental block, that it is such an effective mental block that this is my team. And anything my team does is by definition good, yep. And anything on the other team is by definition bad. And that's going to play out extremely interestingly over the next few months and years, because I have a fairly strong suspicion, and hey, I don't have a crystal ball, but I have a fairly strong suspicion that Donald J. Trump is not going to be is not going to govern the way anyone is expecting him to govern. A lifelong Democrat with Democrat tendencies, I don't think he is actually going to be incredible right-wing Bush on steroids that people
the
on the left...
The great right hope? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, yeah, exactly. I don't think it's going to be like that. I think there's going to be some big surprises in store for everyone. And one example of this, what were the very first words to come out of President-elect Donald J. Trump? Was it, lock her up, yay, you know, now we can do all of those things we talked about on the campaign trail? No, it was, I'd like to thank Hillary Clinton for her service to the country, and she fought a great campaign, and we should all say a sincere thank you to her.
I understand.
I hope that people who supported Donald J. Trump, for whatever reasons they were supporting, will take a good look at what is about to happen and the things he is about to do, and look at them honestly. Not convince yourself that just because I voted for this team and this team is now in power, whatever they do is good. Look at what actually happens and be honest about it. That's all I can say to people who are on board the Trump train right now. Just be honest about what's about to happen, because I'm pretty sure there's going to be some promises reneged on. Let's put it that way.
There's a question of who's really pulling this train. Is it Donald Trump? Is he the big engine that's pulling this train? Or is it all of the people that were fed up with the establishment that said, we're going to back this guy? Is this a populist movement, or is this a Trump movement?
It is 100% a populist movement. It was the people. This is a genuine and authentic expression of a lot of people who are absolutely fed up with the status quo in every sense. The mainstream media, the politicians, the business corporate complex. This is a genuine populist movement and a genuine expression of that. And Trump is just the figurehead of that. And that's what, I mean, almost every Trump supporter that I've interacted with, that is the way they frame their support for him. It's, yeah, he lies and, you know, whatever, he has corruption and he's not going to be perfect, but it is a big middle finger to the establishment. I get that. And I, in some ways, that is very healthy. That needs to happen. But once again, if people get caught up in the politics of this and start supporting the man instead of the movement, then the movement is lost. And I think this
is lost, or does it just sit back and fume for another few years until they get another shot at the White House? Or
in
maybe
some ways
even
that's,
at Congress or the
right,
Senate.
Right. Well, that's true. But in some ways, that's even more depressing, because all that does is further reaffirm in the minds of all of these people that the only outlet that you have for effecting change in the world is to wait for your time to vote. You have to wait for the next election cycle, and then you can vote in another person who promises to do what you want them to do, and then they'll renege on that promise, and then you get to vote for another person who etc., etc. I mean, I get why 20-somethings get caught up in this and really believe in it. I am flabbergasted that people who have seen this happen over and over and
this
over again their
different.
Entire lives truly believe in the bottom of their core of their heart that this time it's different. I can't imagine why they believe that.
Well, a certain amount of hope. I don't know. It is, it's, you know, what fools these mortals be. That's one thing for sure. And it has to even bewilder the politicians. They know they can fool us time and time and time again. But there's got to be a point where even they get kind of sick of it. Wouldn't they rather have an electorate who demanded politicians that were honest and had some measure of real integrity and not just telling us what we want to hear?
Well, personally, I'd rather not think of people as an electorate. I'd like to think of them as people who are individual human beings who can interact with the world and affect change in all sorts of ways that have nothing to do with the federal government or what the President of the United States will or will not do by executive fiat. And until I think that shift in consciousness and understanding takes place, then, yeah, I guess we're trapped in a system where people are just slaves to whatever politician comes along promising things to get into power. I think until we stop defining ourselves as the electorate and start thinking of ourselves as people interacting in communities, communities of interest that we create, then the game is lost. It's not even the right game. It's like playing checkers while someone else is playing Monopoly and trying to merge those games together. If they get you to think of the game as Monopoly instead of checkers or whatever game you want to play, maybe this is a strange and strained analogy, but I hope you get the point. They've got us just thinking in the wrong terms about the wrong things. And if they got you looking for solutions in the wrong places, then you know, who cares? You are enslaved in your mind.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that Trump had a background, historical association with the Democratic Party. He ran as a Republican, and he was roundly rejected by the Republican establishment, and the Democrat establishment has shown no love for him. Is it reasonable to sit back and say that Trump is a third-party candidate who, by a kind of extraordinary miracle, it would be some people's description, but something extraordinary happened where a third-party candidate managed to capture the Republican nomination? I mean, technically, he's not a real Republican, and the evidence is that the at least the establishment, Republican establishment, didn't want him. So what have we got here? Do we have a third-party candidate in the White House?
Yes. I mean, there is certainly that sense, especially when you put it in the context of him running on the Reform Party ticket in 2000. So it's literally what was a third-party candidate has taken over the Republican Party, in a sense. So it certainly isn't within that Republican-Democrat dichotomy. That Republican-Democrat dichotomy, the way it's functioned for decades, has been shattered. And we have yet to see what the pieces, how the pieces of that will sort out and what it will look like, but it will not look the same. So that is some reason for perhaps some window of opportunity slash optimism. But I think rather than framing it as third party, I would almost prefer to say non-party, because I am not convinced there is any ideological affiliation behind Donald Trump or his plans, such as they are. I think it is about being in the moment and what can be on each issue, what can or cannot be done, which, hey, maybe that will be a better governing style for people who are concerned about how people govern other people. But I don't think we can fit that at all into the two-party system as it's existed for decades.
Then do you see Trump less of an ideologue than you do as just a technocrat who has a certain amount of expertise to bring to the job?
It is, in a sense, yeah. I'm not sure I would use the word technocrat, but but certainly that is, I think, a closer approximation. I don't think this is someone with a political ideology per se, but he does have certain political ideals, ideas that he has expressed time and time and time and time again for decades, which I think we should take seriously. One example of that: healthcare, universal healthcare. He probably will scrap Obamacare, but I'm assuming he's going to replace it with Trump Care. He has talked over and over and over throughout the years about being on the side of universal healthcare. He wants universal healthcare. I think he's going to make it happen. I think we're going to get something very similar to Obamacare, but it will be under a different name. So those types of things, again, I think people are going to be surprised when they see it's quite opposite to what they expected.
When we return, we're going to take a break for a couple of commercials in a few seconds. When we return, we're going to start talking about globalists versus nationalists and where the world is turning right now. We're maybe moving away from globalism and toward nationalism. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Is that a dangerous thing? I'm Alfred Addis here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com. We'll be back in a moment. Please stay tuned.
Prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Hi folks, I'm Alfred Addisk here with James Corbett from thecorbettreport.com, and we have been talking about the election, and I was going to move off into globalization versus nationalization right now, but maybe we want to talk about riots. Is that something we want to talk about, James?
Well, I mean, we should at least acknowledge the phenomenon. It's obviously happening as we're recording this, so who knows, you know, where this story is going to be in half an hour, let alone a couple of days. But yes, we have seen massive protests happening in various cities, obviously a lot on the left coast, not surprisingly. And as we're recording this, apparently people have been shot in Seattle during an anti-Trump protest. So this is exactly what I have been worried about with the programmed hate, and why I think it's important to have the message of only love will win the day, will see us through these times, because unfortunately we're heading into potentially very, very, very dark times right now.
We're talking about the political division and great polarization in this country. We're talking about divide and conquer to some degree, aren't we? And you're suggesting that to avoid that division, you actually have to start loving your fellow man and woman, whatever.
The fellow man and woman is not some sort of, you know, troll from another planet. It is human beings who maybe you disagree with them, maybe profoundly disagree with them. But if we start treating them as political obstacles. This is the problem with the political game. You have half the population warring with the other half over who will have control over the country. And when your half doesn't get what it wants, it starts to get angry. And that just ratchets up and up and up, so that the whole political game is just a way to keep half of the population at the other half's throats. Look where that gets us. Look at what that actually accomplishes. I wish there was some way to easily put the brake on all of this, again, the message has to be one about love and understanding more so than hatred and division.
Do you think these riots, multiple riots, do you think these are erupting spontaneously in different locations, or are they being fostered by external forces? Say we need a bunch of riots right now, let's have one in Seattle and one over in wherever in half a dozen cities. Are they being orchestrated, or is this coincidence?
I do not have any data on that, so I can't say definitively. I can say that if we go by recent events, not only in the United States, but in a lot of different places around the world with the color revolutions and what have you, we know there has been outside influence in these protests time and time again, but also in Ferguson, for example, where Soros was paying to bus in people from other places in order to swell the ranks of the protests. So I think we would be naive to think that is not not happening, or even if it is not happening right now, that it will not happen, that this will not be amplified by people who are looking to stir that pot. And again, this plays into so many different agendas, but if you want the militarization of the police state, what better excuse to do so than by cranking up the problem so that the only solution is, oh, dear government, won't you come in with your militarized police state to save us?
Do you think that Trump could have anything to do with this, or is he so far away from the establishment it's not his business? I'm sure that people, and what I mean by that is this, you're implying that there are forces in government that would like to set up a police state, and of course they've been doing it for some time, but they'd like to take a big, they'd like to increase that. Is Trump one of those people?
Yes, I think so. I think he has authoritarian tendencies, and I think that is established on the campaign trail where he was talking about how he wants to implement the death penalty for people who shoot police officers and things like that, which, again, I don't take it seriously as a political policy proposal because there's no way that the president has any ability to do that. He cannot instate the death penalty for certain crimes with a wave of his hand like that. But I think it shows the underlying tendency and the fact that he wants to get people like Snowden and whatever. I think Snowden is a psyop in various ways, but still the sentiment is, you know, these leakers and people are horrible people. We have to cage them and jail them, unless, of course, it's Assange who's helping me out, in which case that's all fine. So I think the authoritarian tendencies are there. I don't have the impression that Trump is part of some coordinated plan, like with the Soroses and whatever, those types of forces. I think it's just his authoritarian nature. The coordinated planning comes from the schemers, I think, more on the New World Order side, however you want to frame it, who see the chaos and see the reaction to the chaos as their way of gaining more order and control over society as part of a planned agenda to move into that more centralized control.
Speaking of George Soros, I published a link to a video of Soros being interviewed about 3 weeks ago on my blog, and Soros looked to be an old, fragile man. He was kind of shaking. He looked like he wasn't fully in control of what he was saying, and he made some extraordinary admissions. He admitted in that video that, first off, he admitted that Hillary was going to lose by a landslide, even though she's his candidate, but he went on and said that they had people in the Electoral College that essentially they'd bought and paid for who might rectify that problem. Do you think the Electoral College is likely to give us a surprise and wipe out Trump's victory and hand it to Hillary?
I do not expect that to happen. If it were to happen like that, can you imagine the reaction?
Yeah, I can.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if some outside influence was looking to create a civil war, that would be the shot heard around the world. There's no way that you could put that easily back in the bottle. So I don't expect that to happen, but if the forces of chaos want chaos, that would be a great way to bring it about, wouldn't it?
I would say so. I've got an article here from Yahoo News quoting Deutsche Bank, which is interesting to me. Deutsche Bank is more in the news since it's gone bankrupt, or is technically bankrupt, than it ever was while it was solvent. But the headline is Bye-Bye Globalization, and one of the bank's strategists, you see, writes, the world has been on a globalization trend since the end of World War II, but looking at the evidence this year, there is compelling reason to believe that globalism is dying. All right, globalism, I'm going to guess, is dying because global free trade is dying. We're in a global, something like at least a global recession, and arguably, from my perspective, a global depression. People are going to disconnect from other countries, in part perhaps to blame other countries for their problems. If we're going from globalization, are we headed to nationalization? And is that nationalization dangerous to us? Is it just a natural part of life? Sine wave, ebb and flow, up for a while, down for a while? Or is it dangerous to us? Do you see nationalization as dangerous?
it's not, I mean, it's not as simple as that. We have to look at the bigger picture of what's happening here. I think this is a repudiation of globalism as it has been proceeding and as we've seen it developing since the 90s with the WTO and what happened in Seattle and places like that, where you had clearly this open conspiracy, I guess we could call it, where the, you know, leaders and people in positions of power go to these enclaves at G20 meetings and what have you to hammer out how globalization is going to proceed behind closed doors in concert with each other in ways that the public has no ability to interact with. And they keep saying, oh, it's for the best. It's going to make a better, prosperous society, whereas people continue to get laid off and feel the effects of that. So this is a repudiation of that. It is it's a big mandate to tear up the TPP, for example, which, again, I would expect that Trump will do, but we'll have to see. But that, and to the extent that that happens, that is a good thing. But as always, it is a question of what is that replaced by, and what is the ultimate effect of that? We are heading into an era of more protectionist policies, and there are short-term benefits and gains that we will see about that. I mean, it's way, way, way too early to be talking about the markets and what this means and things like that. But we have seen, for example, industrial stocks going up after the markets digested what was happening and the futures plunged. But now we see the market rally, and we see, for example, industrial stocks going up on the expectation that, well, he's going to do all these protectionist policies that are going to help American manufacturing and industry. So let's invest in that, and that buoys and there's an upward pressure on wages and things. So this is all good. But let's look at the bigger ramifications of this. A couple of things come to mind. One is that the 1930s were a time of protectionism and basically the grinding to a halt of global trade and beggar thy neighbor type of devaluation policies were going on. And that really was part of the key buildup towards World War II. That is something to keep in mind. The other thing is we've been talking about this over and over for years. We are living in the central bank bubble. It has been going on since the Fed started its bailouts and since the 2008 crisis. They've been pumping in all of that money to keep stocks up, to keep bonds down. We have seen the bubble. We are living in the bubble. The bubble cannot, by definition, cannot last forever. It will crash. If you bring in these protectionist and nationalist policies and the bubble pops, guess what's going to be blamed for it? It's going to be these policies. So that's something for people, even people who are in favor of these policies, to think about. But there's the bigger, bigger picture, which I always look at, and that is that I am not against globalism per se. It's not globalism. It is not because that puts it into a dichotomy. It's globalism versus nationalism. No, I'm against collectivism. And there are two subsets of collectivism. There's globalism and there's nationalism. They are both collectivist mindsets. So at this time, when people are looking for solutions, I hope that they will go back and ponder some things that have been talked about with regards to nationalism and how it is a dangerous collectivist ideology. And one example I'll point people to, George Orwell's Notes on Nationalism, where there's a lot to ponder in there, including where he had that famous quote, "The nationalist does not disapprove of atrocities committed by his own side, but he has a remarkable capacity for not even hearing about them." It's more of the team mentality. Our team, great. That team, bad. And that is a dangerous mindset to be in, whether that's happening with political parties or whether it's happening with nation states or in whatever box people are putting themselves in. It disconnects them from what is really happening, and it makes them support things they otherwise would not support.
I've only got about 3 minutes left, but I've got a question here about external threats. There are rising tensions between NATO and Russia. Are those tensions caused by simple Russian aggression, or does Russia need an external threat to hold Russia together? Is Russia under enough economic and political internal stress that they need a foreign boogeyman in order to hold Russia together?
Well, I, for one, am disgusted that the Russians put their borders so close to all these NATO bases. Clearly, what we're seeing is ramping up of the military threat from the neocons, neolibs, warhawks in the American establishment to a ridiculous degree. And I hope that is the first short-term, immediate change that we will see with this Trump presidency, which is a ratcheting down of that talk. I really hope that does take place because it is ridiculous. But you bring up a good point, which is often missed even in the alternative media, which is that that type of existential threat from NATO, it certainly does have a political use for people like Putin, who is vastly, wildly popular in Russia, largely because the Russians feel, and I think it is an understandable feeling given the overall political climate, they feel an existential threat from NATO, who is threatening at their doorstep. So what happens in those times? You rally around the flag, you rally around the president. There is a political benefit that Putin reaps from that, and I'm sure he's not oblivious to that fact. So it does, like all these military conflicts, it always helps the centers of power to ratchet them up in different ways. Let's hope, and I don't put a lot of emphasis on hope and change, but let's hope that there really is a ratcheting down, because that does not benefit anyone in the general population with these ridiculous militaristic statements that have been made in recent years.
We've got rising tensions between NATO and Russia. It might serve Russia's interest to see those to create an external threat. But what about European leaders who worry about Brexit tensions within the European Union that could cause the European Union to disintegrate? Does the European Union need an external threat to hold the EU together?
That's one of the factors at play, but I think the European Union is about to face, there are elections coming up in a number of core EU countries that could see similar phenomena to what we've been experiencing. We're seeing the changing of the political landscape, how politics have been functioning. So, I'm not sure the same old boogeyman warmongering in the same old ways will work to rally people in the same way as they have before. I really hope there's been a change in that, because that is obviously not the way we want to continue to proceed. Question is always what comes along to change that, or to change that calculus, and we'll have to see if the world becomes more peaceful. And if so, let's all rejoice.
If both sides, NATO and Russia, Europe and Russia, if they both need an external threat, and they're both pointing fingers at each other, does that increase the possibility that this will degrade into real war, and you've only got about 10 seconds to answer?
Yes, if that's the game plan. But there are people within the hierarchies on all sides that also do not want that and are trying to steer it away from that. Let's hope that they win in that particular battle.
All right, James, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for your answers, insight, intelligence. We'll look forward to talking to you again in 2 weeks. I'm Alfred Addisk, and this is Financial Survival. Melody and I will be back tomorrow. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, Todd, the producer, and James Corbett.
I work all night, I work all day to pay the bills I have to pay. Ain't it sad? And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad.